I'm substituting for Janet McAllister, who unfortunately couldn't be here, no matter how hard she tried. So I've prepared some slides, and I've talked to Janet. I'm going to talk a little bit about some field trials that she's done. She has been associated very closely with them. She's either conducted them or designed them or been associated with them in some way. So if you have some really detailed questions about the trials that I'll show, you can get a hold of her, and I put our contact information at the back. Just to reiterate, and we've had a nice introduction to West Nile virus with our first talk, just the challenges, and there are numerous challenges, of which I've listed a few here. With any disease that's carried by insects, you have a complex interaction between the vector, the host, and the virus, or whatever it is. And in this case, we have a large number of vectors. Each have their own behavior and somewhat different biology, so you have to take that into account when you're trying to control them. The West Nile virus now covers a huge geographic range, the entire United States, because I've limited this just to the U.S. There are a limited number of insecticides, as we've heard. Insecticide resistance is always a potential. Another challenge is implementing a West Nile virus control program. And then, as you've heard from a number of other talks, there is a need for more knowledge. There's still an incomplete understanding of the entire disease complex, in spite of all the work that's been done. So just a brief history. It was first isolated in the West Nile district in Uganda, hence the name West Nile virus. It was detected in the U.S. in 1999, and it probably came in on a bird or mosquito. And then it began in the New York area and then spread across the country. It's a virus. It's part of the encephalitis enogenic complex of viruses. Mainly infects birds, but it can affect humans, horses, and alligators. And the alligator problem is important if you happen to raise alligators and then a number of other vertebrates. And it's usually spread by infected mosquitoes. And although it's rare to become infected from blood transfusions, there have been cases from organ transplants or actually handling juvenile infected alligators. And this is just a electron micrograph of the virus. In the U.S., it's primarily spread by those three Culex species. Each region seems to have its own particular species. It can also be spread by several Aedes and Ophelus species, as well as a few species belonging to the number of genera that I've listed there at the bottom of the slide. Now I just pictured three of our friends that happened to spread the disease. And one of the challenges is the symptoms. The symptoms range from none, so you could have it and not know it, to a slight fever, a headache, or a rash, or you suddenly get headaches and the symptoms are stronger. You have a stiff neck, confusion, weakness, maybe a coma. And in very rare cases, you can develop encephalitis or meningitis that can lead to permanent brain damage or death. Now, that's very rare, but it does happen. And again, birds are the major host and the major amplifying host. There are other animals like humans and horses that can contract the virus, but it's a dead-end host. It can't propagate from there. And the birds, because they can migrate or fly miles, I mean, the virus can be spread hundreds of miles, or maybe thousands. And there are a lot of bird species out there that can take care of the virus. Greater than 280 can be infected. But in the U.S., the most important species are the robin, crows, mourning doves, and blue jays, but there's a list of other species that are also pretty effective in propagating the virus. And then there are over 30 species of other mammals that are affected. And then, again, I came across a paper that showed that the juvenile alligators, at least for a temporary time, if they don't die, can serve as an amplifying host. And this is just an aside, but I was I guess surprised to find out that the alligator rearing business is worth several millions of dollars. So the alligator raisers are very interested in this. This is just some of the birds that transmit the virus. And like I said, it was first introduced in the New York area in 1999. The next year, in 2000, it had spread around the initial site of infestation. And then by 2001, it had moved down the eastern seaboard to the point that it was in Florida and as far over as New Orleans. Then the next year, and I don't know if this is because of more monitoring or the fact that it moved that fast, we saw an earlier series of slides that showed how the West Nile virus has spread across the country. This shows the intensity of the disease. So the red dots show the very intense disease area. The green is where they found any activity at all. So by 2002, from 1999, the virus had spread about two-thirds of the way across the country. And by 2003, it had spread a little further west and had reached California. But you can notice through the center, through the plain states, from Texas up to North Dakota and Montana, that was the most intensive area of infections. And then by 2004, intensity let up, but it had spread even further to so it was up the West Coast. In 2005, intensity has returned. So it's all over the country, and it spread very quickly. So again, the challenge is this interaction of people, the vector, the virus. This is just a quick diagram of the transmission cycle. And you can see there with the birds, the virus, and the vectors, that there are a number of things that can affect any one of those. And really, to get the transmission, you have to have the bird that's infected. You have to have the mosquito there to pick up the virus that can transmit it to the next bird. So if one of those things is missing, you won't get the disease. And then there are the incidental hosts like people, horses, and other animals. And then the weather and climate. If the weather is wrong, so that it is is not favorable to the mosquitoes, then you'll get less transmission, or to the birds, the same thing. And it's this large number of vectors, I think, that's a problem. And you can see here that although there are more 80 species that can transmit the disease, Culex is really the most important in the U.S. And these other species, or these other genera, you can see the number of species that they found that can actually transmit the disease. And this is important because each of these species and genera have slightly different behavior patterns, and when you're trying to develop some type of a spray program, you have to take all this behavior and biology into account. And again, it's a large geographic range. And by 2006, there's a 2007 data, but I don't have it here. You can see that it's moved clear across the country, but for some reason it tends to be the most severe through the center of the country. And we have a limited number of insecticides, and that's been brought out several times with these different vectors and pests. Basically, we have organophosphates, nalid malathion. We have some pyrethroids for the adulticides, organophosphate for larvicides, some microbials, VTI, and a growth regulator. And that's basically what there is to work with right now. And although there is a possibility of one or two new compounds coming along, at the current time, this is what there is. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the implementation of a West Nile virus program. It's different in some ways from a malaria program, because on a malaria program, you're focusing on internal sprays, bed nets. But with the West Nile, it's not internal residential sprays. It's covering wide areas out in the field, requiring fogging or wide area sprays. So it's kind of a complementary type control. And a lot of times, the people that are setting these programs up confuse mosquito control with West Nile virus control. So they're totally focused on killing mosquitoes, but maybe not doing and implementing the things that might reduce those mosquitoes without spraying. Because as you hear over and over again, to really get a sustainable program, you have to incorporate not only the insecticides, but also anything that'll have a negative impact on the mosquito or the transmission of the virus. So the objective of a West Nile virus control program is to reduce the virus, not necessarily to reduce mosquito numbers. And resistance, as always, is a potential. There are only a few classes of chemistry that we have seen, two or three, and there's no, with the exception of one or two possible compounds, there's nothing readily apparent. And resistance has been detected at some place in the U.S. to all the insecticides that are now being used. And this is an example of the vector program in Texas that was carried out in Harris County. It's the third largest county in the U.S. And has a population of 3.5 million people, covers about 1,800 square miles. And three-fourths of the land is Houston, and then there's some smaller communities around it. Each one of these places has its own mosquito control program. So in this, even though it's a large area, you have a bunch of different programs that are not necessarily coordinated. And then you have 50,000 irrigated acres that are planted with rice and these other crops, and you have cattle and horses and hogs, poultry. So you have an area that's favorable for mosquitoes. One of the things that may be a big factor with West Nile virus is that when you're irrigating, you can have areas of small puddles of water or larger temporary lakes, but these mosquitoes only require 10 to 14 days to do a life cycle. So you've got all these little places out there where you can be breeding thousands of mosquitoes. And in some of these areas where it's drier, the birds tend to be around where the water is, so you've got the mosquitoes, the water, and everything is perfect for the disease. Now, one of the things that's happened is that the SLE is St. Louis encephalitis. Up until West Nile virus appeared in this county, they were treating about 60 areas here for the SLE. With the advent of West Nile virus, that's now doubled to about 135 sites that are being sprayed. So they're actually, and the sprays do not necessarily coincide. So you're getting much more selection pressure on the mosquitoes that are there, and that's not good. This is a snapshot of one of their areas and what the CDC is doing to try to get a better understanding of the mosquitoes. They have the areas that are in that blue-green are their sentinel areas, and they've gone back to those sites year after year after year to the same locations to establish a historical database. And then what they've done in some of these places is they've set up traps over in this area, and then they have concentric rings where they trap out further because they're trying to find out something about movement of the virus and the mosquitoes to get a better understanding of just the specific biology and movement of the mosquitoes. And they've also been interested in resistance. So here's just kind of a quick summary of what's been going on in that area in the last several years since 1965. And in the first, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in there, there was Bagon, Ficam, Dursban was used, Dibrome. And then they came up later when those products began to fail, they switched to natural pyrethroids. But one thing that was used is malathion was used from day one and was used to about 2001. Then it failed and they stopped using it. And they introduced resmethrin. But the thing to keep in mind is they had 100-fold resistance to malathion in 2001. Then in 2005, they'd done some sampling and found out that the malathion resistance had disappeared. And even though you can see a little bit of difference from site to site, each one of these numbers represents a different site. So in 2005, you're getting, remembering back that they were getting almost no control at all with malathion, now you're getting 90%+. And in most of the sites there. So there is some indication of slight resistance. but it's nothing like it existed a few years earlier. So they are also trying to find out what the mechanism is, and they've been doing some tests where they bring the mosquitoes in and test them with some, with PBO to see if it's oxidases, or DEF to see if it's an esterase, and they're also doing some molecular testing. But what they found is, in this particular location, that it seems to be an esterase type resistance. At this point, the PBO had almost no impact at all. So they've done that for all these sites that are shown here, and they found that at different sites they either have esterase resistance or oxidase resistance. And there are a few places there where they've got a third mechanism that they think may be target site, but they're not sure, and they're working on that right now. And one of the things they do when they do these tests, they have a cage of lab susceptible mosquitoes that they put out there with wild mosquitoes they've collected, just to show that it wasn't a misapplication that caused the survival of the mosquitoes. And this is a test they did. Unfortunately, they only did a few areas, but the area 51, 55, and 67, and put malathione again, and there is something out there, because they're getting somewhere between 80 and 85%, which is still pretty good. But in area 51, that was definitely much more difficult population right there, because sumethrin and permethrin were only given, I don't know, 10 to 25% mortality, and even resmethrin was only given about 60%. In area 67, it was up to about 82, 85%. Control. So what they found is that there are areas with no resistance detected, and the recommendation is that even though they've not detected resistance, they need to implement all the best IRM practices that they're aware of, and that they have to make sure that they keep the program cost effective to ensure continued success, because like in other areas of the country, the people that are involved in applying the cost of the insecticides in the program is paramount. In the areas with resistance, they started alternating the classes, and they switched to high rates. And they the way they got around to having no change in the resmethrin rate is that they doubled the amount, but then have the number of treatments. So I'm not sure that's the best thing, but that's the program they implemented. And they found that there's an additional cost for malathione, but in some cases they've had to do it. But like in other areas of the world, cost is an overriding factor. So you can develop a successful program, but it has to be cost effective or people won't implement it. So one of the things they do a day-to-day surveillance. They have an easy test to monitor for resistance throughout the county. Obviously, they cannot test every single site, so they've chosen selected sites to work at. And then when they detect some type of resistance or a loss in control, they quickly confirm to see if it's due to some other factor than resistance. And then where they do find resistance, they're changing strategies. And what they found, like with malathione, it appears as though the populations have recovered their susceptibility to malathione. But does that mean they go back to the same way that they were controlling the mosquitoes before? How long will it last? Do they need to change the strategy? That's one of the questions that's open right now. Another big problem with the West Nile virus or mosquito control programs is public acceptance. And again, the confusion of the West Nile virus control program and a spray program. But one of like I said earlier, the number of mosquito districts and the coordination of methods and applications is a major problem, getting everything to happen at the same time, the same way. And then another thing that has an impact on resistance development, in addition to West Nile virus control and spraying for mosquitoes for that, There's also nuisance spraying for mosquitoes because people don't like to be bitten when they walk out in the yard. So there's a lot of non-West Nile virus program spraying. So even though they're spraying maybe every week or 2 weeks for the West Nile virus, there's a lot of other spraying going. So the actual number of sprays may be higher than is reported. And then some of these programs really focus on mosquito reduction. And while there's a relationship, you also need to do other things to reduce the incidence of West Nile virus. And I think to get public acceptance of these programs, people need to have a much better understanding of the total West Nile virus situation, the biology of the birds, the mosquitoes, what the impact of the disease is, so they'll understand why it needs to be done. There, there are a number of direct costs that are significant. It costs a lot for the insecticides and for the applications. They try to do fogging, which means they've got to get the material out there at dusk or at dawn when the mosquitoes are flying. The monitoring for resistance that's being done and the monitoring for the virus is expensive. Those are direct costs. And then if you're in areas where they're raising alligators and you're losing your alligator farm, that's very expensive to you. But there are a lot of indirect costs that are difficult to really measure. But now all the blood that's being collected and used has to be tested for West Nile virus. And then you have people that have a more significant reaction than just a mild headache. And the people that maybe they're not die, but they're hospitalized or sick for a long time. You have the cost of the care for these people, plus the work they've missed. And it's the same with people that have less serious infections. Productivity loses. It's hard to quantify that, but these are all things that really support acceptance of a West Nile virus control program. And still, there's a lot of things that are not understood about West Nile virus. More extensive research is done. They've done a tremendous amount of work down in Texas with the modeling and with the programs, but there's a whole country involved, and the disease has only been here for a few years. But still, there are questions that are unanswered. And one of them that I talked to Janet about is, in this red rectangle, over the years since they started monitoring there, the incidence of the West Nile virus has been greatest in these states that run from the northern part of Texas up to the Canadian border, and they've not come up with any good explanation for that. If anybody has an idea, I'm sure Janet would be thrilled to find out what may be causing that. But it's because I think a lot more very specific information needs to be learned, and I think that goes along with all the other vector diseases in Africa or wherever. It's specific information that the people want to know. When you go into a place and say you've got to rotate, their question is rotate to what and what rate and when do I spray. You can't tell them just employ best practices. You have to tell them what the best practices are. Because I know if I was going down maybe not for an insecticide, but if I want directions for something, I don't want use it the best you can. I want specific information. And I think that is the direction that needs to be, that research needs to go. Because without that specific detail, you can't develop a program. So we just need to develop programs that also incorporate very good susceptibility management practices as well as mosquito control, include different modes of action, and again, utilize chemical and non-chemical controls. Again, more research is needed, new chemistry is needed, and the control programs need to be economically feasible, but they need to incorporate all the best IPM and IRM practices possible. And there's our contact information. If you have any really detailed questions, feel free to contact Janet, or you can email me. Thank you. I didn't. Well, I was focusing on the U.S., so I didn't look there. And I got these from the CDC, so.
Has anyone done that?
I haven't seen it, but I think there's some up into Canada. I had to go back through the papers. I don't know about Mexico.
Okay.
But I'm sure there's some data north of North Dakota.